Hi, this is John Udell. I am joined today by Peter Suber. He's an advocate for open access to scientific and scholarly research literature. He's the director of the Open Access Project at Public Knowledge, and he's the author of the Open Access News blog. I've learned about the open access movement in bits and pieces, but Peter's the perfect guy to paint the big picture, so let's tune in and hear what he has to say.
Hello.
Peter, hi, this is John Udell.
Oh, hi, John.
What I was hoping to get from you, among other things, is some connecting of dots, you know, sort of as an outsider to what I guess is now called the open access movement. I see lots of different manifestations of it. So I'm aware of the Public Library of Science, and I'm aware of, well, going way back, obviously, the LANL archive.
Right.
I heard a talk by Paula Ledoux of Creative Commons about some work that they're doing in relationship to this. And, you know, so you get sort of bits and pieces of the story.
Yep.
And I thought it would be really kind of helpful, since you are probably paying as close attention to the whole landscape as anyone, to try to just chart out what are the different pieces, what are the moving parts to this puzzle, first
yep.
of all.
I'd be glad to help with that.
Okay.
Okay, the best way to start is that you've mentioned some projects with that publish open access journals,
yeah.
like the Public Library of Science, and some that we call open access repositories, like the Archive,
yeah.
formerly LANL, now at Cornell. And open access journals and open access repositories or archives are the two primary ways to deliver open access. And so the movement tends to focus on different ways of producing journals and different ways of producing archives.
Mm-hmm.
They're completely compatible and complementary, but they're significantly different from each other. The main difference is that journals provide peer review and archives or repositories do not. But they both provide open access. And so open access isn't a kind of journal, it's a kind of access.
Mm-hmm.
And the access can be provided in many different ways. And I should say that while these are the two primary vehicles for delivering open access, there are lots of other ones like wikis, P2P networks, RSS feeds, blogs, discussion forums, any kind of access that's free of charge and free of most permission barriers, that is, most copyright and licensing restrictions, qualifies as open access.
Mm-hmm.
But the two vehicles that matter most for scholarship are journals that provide peer review and archives that simply disseminate work that may or may not have been peer reviewed.
Right. So LANL is a preprint archive, and
primarily preprint.
Yeah.
It does have some postprints, but it's primarily preprints.
Okay. Which means a lot of that stuff is on the publication track, but
yes.
also a lot isn't, I guess.
Right.
And okay.
The original idea was that they were all on the publication track, but I think it's true that for many authors, archive is so effective at getting the work out that it suffices, and some of the authors just don't pursue any.
Really?
Yes. In fact, there's a pretty famous case now of a mathematician who might have proved an important conjecture, and he's only disseminated his work through preprints on archive,
mm-hmm.
and journals have begged with him to publish with them. In other words, they're saying, we'll do it. Basically, we've done the peer review. Just let us do it. And he's not consenting. Basically, he's reached the audience that he cares to reach.
Yeah.
He's already got the review from his colleagues that he cares to have.
He's got the feedback that
right.
he values and,
yep.
and trusts and that he thinks matters.
Right. So if you want, you could distinguish classical or conventional peer review from the new kinds of review that are enabled by interactive networks. Some people call it Web 2.0. But Archive has had that all along.
Right.
It's always stimulated interactivity in the relevant communities.
Yes.
It's not the same as classical peer review, but for some scientists, that's enough. Some of those papers are not really on a track to formal publication anymore, even though I think it's fair to say most of them really are.
Okay. Well, I have a few questions more about Archive, but
yeah.
let's kind of, you know, paint the rest of the picture in first.
Okay. Well, those are the two big vehicles, and there's lots of variations on each theme. Many kinds of open access journal, many kinds of open access repository. And I could say more about all of that if you like.
If you could enumerate some of the more well-known ones, just so we can triangulate on what we're talking about.
Yeah. On the journal side, there are some fairly large open access publishers who publish nothing but open access journals. Public Library of Science is maybe the best known.
Yeah.
Another very well-known one is the Biomed Central. Biomed Central publishes more than 120 open access journals.
Okay.
And that makes it by far the largest open access publisher. Hindawi Publishing in Cairo publishes now, I think, roughly 40 open access journals. That makes it the second largest open access publisher. Public Library of Science publishes 7, I think.
Okay.
And there are lots of small open access publishers that publish one or two journals. And there's a growing number of commercial and society publishers who publish primarily non-open access journals but are doing experiments with open access.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the popular experiments these days is with what are called hybrid open access journals. In a typical or full open access journal, all the articles are open access. And a common way to pay the bills is to charge a fee to cover the costs of peer review and editing. And the bill goes to the author even if the money is paid by the author's research grant or employer.
Right.
So sometimes they're misleadingly called author fees. I don't like that term because it scares authors, and
right.
It's not true that they pay.
Right.
But that's not the only business model, but it's a common model. And for a typical open access journal, all the articles are open access, and they're all supported by fees of that kind.
Okay.
With a hybrid open access journal, there's a choice. The author can choose open access or conventional access. If the author chooses conventional, then the author pays nothing, and readers have pay-per-view access or subscription access. They have to pay or be affiliated with an institution that pays in order to get access. But if they choose open access, then they pay the fee, and they get immediate open access for the world. The reason this kind of experiment is spreading is that it's completely risk-free for the publisher. The publishers have been afraid of full open access because uh-huh. they're not sure that they could pay all the bills charging publication fees to the author side. And in some fields, that model seems to be working. In other fields, it probably wouldn't work. It depends on how many papers are funded or how much research is funded in those fields. So the publishers have some reason to worry that that model may not apply as well to every research niche. But this model works perfectly well. If authors can't come up with the money or don't feel that it's worth it, they don't pay, and the publisher still gets subscription revenue from subscribers.
How are the incentives working out for the authors or for the backers of the research, and to what extent do people understand what they're paying for and feel that that's a good bargain?
I've seen several studies of author attitudes toward open access journals. Those studies tend to limit themselves to the journals that charge fees, and it's important to point out that only a minority of open access journals charge fees.
Okay.
The majority charge no fees at all.
Okay.
And they pay their bills through some kind of institutional subsidy. But these author attitude studies focus on the ones that do charge fees. And for authors who have never done it before, the idea of paying a fee is a deterrent.
Oh, it would certainly be off-putting.
Especially because, on the whole, they haven't been paying fees up until now.
Yeah.
However, in many fields, it's customary to pay page charges and color charges. And authors are accustomed to getting charged even when the reader is also being charged at the other end on a subscription basis.
Mm.
And so they're not too surprised in some fields to be asked. And authors who really understand the landscape can tell the difference between color charges and open access publication charges.
Mm-hmm.
The important difference is that you're paying for open access. You're not just paying for color plates on private access or paid access. And by getting open access, you're gaining access to a larger audience than you would get from any journal in the world, regardless of how popular or prestigious it is.
Mm-hmm. A larger audience and a radically more powerful way to monitor the citation.
At least in principle. The many different projects are still working on new automated ways to take advantage of the traffic data and the citation data on open access articles.
Right.
Basically, it's all there for harvesting, or could be there if we got everybody to cooperate. And so long term, there'll be wonderful citation tracking for open access literature. But the tools that do it now haven't taken full advantage of that.
So what's funny when you look at that from the perspective of blogging is that it seems that in that world we have an extraordinarily complete accounting of the citations of our own stuff to the extent that those citations are also expressed as links.
Yes.
On public blogs. It has actually been one of the most astonishing things to me that mechanisms such as TrackBack, for example, have seemed not to be necessary in the end, because the search engines and the aggregators do such an effective job that the instant that someone publishes something that touches one of my things, I know it. You know, it's like I've got this array of sensors out there that is exquisitely tuned. And
I know exactly what you mean.
And so you just kind of wonder, I mean, is it really that hard?
At least for blogs. And it's a nice question why it works so well for blogs, and we're so slow to match that service with other kinds of literature. And it may be that blogs are already XML marked up.
I don't think it's that. I actually think it's more that there, and this is a weird inversion in a way, because I don't think bloggers think of themselves as researchers or academics in any sense. Yet, in a lot of ways, they behave as such. In blogging culture, there's a very strong respect for primary sources, and people are very scrupulous about citing and about provenance. It's that culture, more than anything, that enables these processes to work effectively. And I would have thought that we would see much more in the way of academic blogging than we have seen. And when I talk to academics about this, it seems to boil down to, well, there's really not much I can say, you know, because my work is funded and my publications are copyrighted, and or I'm working in a competitive field and I don't want to show my hand. And so they're saying all the kinds of things that seem contrary to what the spirit of science has always been understood to be.
I agree with you, except that I noticed more and more academic blogging.
Yeah.
Not just by professors on non-academic subjects, but even on their academic subjects.
Yeah.
And there are also some other reasons not to do it. Some people are punished by their hiring and promotion committees when they do it non-pseudonymously.
Yeah.
And that's a shame. Even when they're strictly sticking to academic subjects, there's a kind of candor or lack of inhibition on blogs, which is part of the genre, that gets some in trouble. And this is not peer-reviewed. It's looked down upon as unfiltered literature.
Right.
But despite all that, more and more academics are blogging on academic subjects, and I think that's a good thing, and I think we'll see more and more of it. It's a very rapid way to get your word out, and as you say, once it's out, it's well integrated into search mechanisms and discovery mechanisms.
Yeah.
That is, it's a handy way to provide open access, preservation, and discovery before you get around to doing anything else with it.
Even if you get around to doing anything else
with
it, right? And part of the reason why you would is that the formative material will have provoked a reaction or not, right?
Yep.
And that's information in itself. And
yep. Some academic bloggers are taking advantage of this kind of enlarged discussion to help formulate their own thoughts. So they'll put something out hoping for a comment. They'll get the comment, and they'll use that in an upcoming article. That is, they'll just write a better article than they would have.
Exactly. In situations where what you're doing is not inherently competitive or confidential or proprietary, it's hard to see how you'd want to do it any other way. Now, I heard a great talk by John Walensky, whose book, The Access Principle, I've also been reading recently. It's one of the best talks I've ever heard. I mean, the guy is wicked funny, among other things. You know, he made this appeal to academics about open publishing, and what he said was, this deal won't last forever, because right now, I think he said something like 15% of everything is what he would call open access, which
15% of new things tend to get open archived.
Wow, that seems like a lot, actually. I mean, that's more than I might have guessed. And of those, there's, you say, a relatively small proportion where the author has paid, and most of it's not that way.
Well, this 15% refers to any kind of open access.
Okay,
and most of that will be deposited in open access archives or repositories.
Okay,
I really don't know the percentage that comes out in open access journals. But whatever it is, about half of those have paid publication fees, and half of them have not.
Okay. But one of the funny things that he said was, you realize that when you do this, you're going to quintuple your citation count, because obviously people can link to you where before they couldn't.
And they'll know about you.
And they'll know about you, and so it's got all these wonderful reputation-enhancing effects, you know. But he said, this is a short-term deal, because right now, you'll be in the minority when you do that. So you want to get out ahead, because it won't be such a distinction once everyone is doing this, right?
He's right, but that's only half the story. Basically, there are two kinds of open access impact advantage. One is the early adopter advantage, and you'll have a larger audience than the people who are not archiving their work in open repositories.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's the intrinsic advantage, and even after everybody starts to do this, everybody will have more citations than they had in the old system, because their work will be seen more widely by people who need it.
In a way, we have a kind of a controlled experiment here, because Archive has been going for, 15 or more years?
15, since 1991.
Yeah. So in those disciplines that it covers, which is, I guess, mostly physics, math, and computer science,
computational biology.
Yeah, quantitative biology. We have 15 years worth of experience to look back on. So in your estimation, what's been the effect of that being the dominant mode of information exchange in those disciplines over, you know, this long period of time?
One of the most important results is the one we both alluded to already, which is the way open access increases citation impact.
Yeah.
It increases audience, but that translates into citation impact, which can be measured.
Yep.
And the increase is between 50 and 250%. Studies have been done in just about every discipline, and the same effect shows. It's just that we have longer experience and better data for physics or the disciplines covered by the archive.
So people are being cited more, but what does that lead to?
Well, that leads to promotion and tenure. It leads to career advancement. That's really the coin of the realm for publishing scholars, at least in the sciences. The fact about scholarly publishing that makes open access possible is that scholars are not paid for their journal articles. So that makes them essentially different from musicians and movie makers who want to get paid for their work. Because scholars are not paid, they write for impact, mm-hmm. not for money. And impact isn't abstract anymore. Impact can be measured primarily through citations. And if your citation count rises 50 to 250% by providing open access, then as soon as scholars understand that, they'll do it.
This is enlightened self-interest at work,
exactly.
And that's great. But obviously, you know, behind all of this attention-seeking behavior, there lurks the actual process of science and the advancement of knowledge. And so I'm just curious if...
Oh, you mean how? What kind of discoveries has it made?
Have these disciplines, in general, been more productive
yeah.
over this period of time as a result? I mean, can we point to any evidence that's
true?
That's
a good question. There are a couple anecdotes that show that open access does increase productivity. And I'm waiting for more studies because I think that's the ultimate benefit of open access.
Yes.
It accelerates research
yes.
and the productivity of researchers. But it's hard to measure and document that. But one example of it is that the genome sequence of the SARS virus, or the genome of the SARS virus, was sequenced in about 7 days because the data of the different teams working on the project was openly shared.
Mm-hmm.
And it took about 3 years to sequence the genome of the AIDS virus. To be fair, the AIDS virus was sequenced at an earlier time when
right.
the technology wasn't as good.
Right.
But it was the open data sharing that really facilitated the SARS sequencing project. And it sort of seems obvious to scientists that if you share data and if you share the articles analyzing data openly, that productivity has to be enhanced. We're just waiting for more anecdotes like this to come along.
Right. So then let's talk about the counter-incentives. And so one that I've heard is that in a variety of disciplines, people are playing a game of, well, let's wait and see. You know, if you've already made your career, you know, then you're not sacrificing anything by going to an open access journal. But if I haven't made my career yet, then I
yes.
can't take that risk, right?
That's true, and there's kind of two offsetting considerations here. Older, established, tenured faculty have less at risk.
Yes.
And they can send their best work to open access journals, and they won't be denied tenure for it. And many senior faculty see it exactly that way, and they're helping the cause by doing just that. On the other hand, senior faculty know much less about open access than junior faculty,
mm-hmm.
and are much less juiced by the concept.
Mm-hmm.
And junior faculty are highly excited by it and sometimes feel constrained by their career advancement. And so some junior faculty archive at a high rate because they believe in the cause, and some at a low rate because they're afraid that it won't advance their career as quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But there are ways to answer the reservations that junior faculty have. If they really need a prestigious publication to advance their career, and I agree that they do, they can publish in a non-open access prestigious journal if they can get in, and they can still deposit a copy of the postprint, the peer-reviewed version of their article, in an open access repository.
Hmm.
So they can have the best of both worlds. It's almost never a trade-off. And the reason for that is that one of the accomplishments of the open access movement is to persuade about 70% of non-open access journals to permit their authors to deposit the peer-reviewed postprint in an open access repository.
Hmm. So you're saying that's the majority of agreements now?
Yeah, about 70%. Permit this in advance with no request necessary. It's part of the copyright transfer agreement. You have this right to do it if you feel like it.
Oh, so there's no downside to that then?
There's no downside at all. The only problem for us, for advocates and activists, is to get authors to understand that this is true.
Yes.
That's hard. It's unbelievably hard. That's one of the biggest obstacles to open access right now. Most publishing scholars still don't know much about open access,
right?
Because they're so focused on their research and because they're so busy. But as soon as they understand what it is and that it's not a trade-off with publishing in a prestigious non-open access journal,
right,
they see the logic of it and they just start participating.
Wow.
But I should add that publishers are feeling more and more threatened by open access archiving. They think it will undercut subscriptions. And so while 70% of surveyed journals have already given this kind of permission, some of them are reconsidering.
Yeah.
And they may be retracting some of that.
Yeah.
If they can get away with it. I think some of them are thinking, we would already have retracted if we didn't fear that it would antagonize our authors.
There's the other problem, which is that, as I understand it, a lot of data is necessarily held proprietary because the sponsors of the research won't have it any other way.
A lot of it is, and a lot of it isn't. And open access to data raises a different set of issues, but that's one of them.
Mm-hmm.
It's gratifying that many journals that are not themselves open access have open access requirements on data. So if you publish in Nature, for example, you have to make the data openly accessible or they won't accept your paper for publication.
Hmm.
Nature should apply the same principle to its articles, but it doesn't.
In the field of medicine, at least according to a very disturbing but I thought excellent book by John Abramson called Overdosed America. He's a former family doc for many years, but also a hospital administrator and a statistician, research statistician. And he sort of put all those things together a few years back, and one day he was in his office reading an article in one of the medical journals about Vioxx, and he looked at the data and he said, I don't think this adds up. And he started to dig and dig, and he got more and more concerned, and he figured out that there was something bogus going on there, and he went on to write this book in which he makes some extremely serious allegations about the fact that a lot of the data that supports articles in these kinds of journals is not completely available even to the authors of the papers.
One of the most effective parts of the open data movement is addressing just that problem.
Yeah.
Drug trial data
yeah.
is becoming open, even if other kinds of data are not.
Yeah.
And it's because of Vioxx. It's because of cases in which only the data showing beneficial effects is available and the data showing negative consequences is unavailable.
Mm-hmm.
Legislators realize that that's a problem. Doctors realize it's a problem. Patients realize it's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And people who are participating as subjects in the experiments think that's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody wants to solve this problem, and more drug companies are voluntarily complying, but their compliance is incomplete or scattered, and it's certainly not assured long-term. So legislators are trying to mandate this, and before legislators get around to finishing the job, journals are taking over and saying, we're just not going to publish articles about new drugs unless the underlying data are completely open access.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an open access drug trial repository in the NIH called clinicaltrials.gov. And it's completely open access, and it's large and well-managed and well-organized and searchable. And most of these journals that put this requirement on data say it has to be there. It can't be at your own website where it could disappear tomorrow.
Well, that's encouraging. So you're saying that it's actually kind of hopeful.
It is hopeful.
That's good to know. So you have followed in your newsletter all of the developments around the proposed legislation
yep.
to require this of. I hear about this mostly in the context of the NIH. Is that right?
Well, the NIH was the first one, but there are several others now. There are two bills presently before Congress. One would generalize the NIH policy to the other medical funding agencies within the Department of Health and Human Services.
Mm-hmm.
That includes the CDC.
Well, first of all, what is the NIH policy, and what's been the effect of it so far?
Yeah, the NIH policy is a request, not a requirement,
mm-hmm.
to its grantees to put the peer-reviewed versions of any publications arising from NIH-funded research into PubMed Central,
mm-hmm.
which is an open-access repository
mm-hmm.
hosted by the NIH. And it's a great idea. The only real weakness is that it's a request and not a requirement.
Mm-hmm.
And after, I think it was 8 months of operation, they had only 3.8% compliance from their grantees,
okay.
which everybody agrees is dismally low. Congress originally asked for a requirement, not a request, and NIH softened it. And after they softened it, Congress acquiesced. So NIH went forward, but the policy is clearly not meeting the agency's goals. It's not meeting Congress's goals. There's now a clause in the recent appropriation report from the House to convert this to a requirement
mm-hmm.
based on the low participation rate. And the NIH will probably move in that direction, and it certainly ought to. That's what it needs to become stronger.
I wonder if there's not a carrot approach to this as opposed to a stick approach. I think you and I would agree that ultimately having your data out there is in your own interest for the same reasons that you'd want to, to the extent that you could, you'd want to effectively blog about your work, right? In order to provoke the kind of interaction that's going to lead you to better results, to more productivity, to new discoveries. Won't it be the case that, that people will just figure out that to the extent that you're behind a wall and invisible, you are, you know, you're hurting yourself?
Studies have shown that authors don't oppose this. They're just very busy. You're absolutely right about the carrot. The real benefit for authors in compliance is that their work reaches a larger audience. The policy only applies to papers that have already been published. And so this is work that authors are already trying to get out there to people who can build on it.
Mm-hmm.
And they can only reach a larger group if they comply with the NIH policy.
Yeah.
The NIH tries to offer another carrot as well. At the end of the grant period, grantees have to report showing what they did. And if they deposit their work in PubMed Central, that clears a certain part of this review process. And without that, they would have to submit a hard copy, which is a little bit more onerous.
Mm-hmm.
And it certainly doesn't spread their work to other people.
Mm-hmm.
So they can do double duty. They have something to do at the end of the process anyway. And this is just another way of checking that off their list.
Right. There's a path of least resistance.
That's right.
Which sort of leads to another speculation, which is that over time, what's going to happen is more and more of the work that people do is going to be supported by software that lives, if you will, in the network. I mean, it seems like a lot of these discussions are really around where is the information, where is the data? And if it's created here, now how do I move it there? Take it from one place and put it in another place. When the technology is increasingly wanting to be about syndication and access rather than primary location.
Right.
I'm perfectly happy to publish everything to my blog with the understanding that it gets syndicated out to the places that it needs to be with my permission, and that the processes that are running around in the network that are connecting my stuff to other people's stuff, it's all sort of organic and natural, right? I don't have to pick something up and put it somewhere in order to activate that process. There's an aspect of the evolution of our software tools that will lead us in that direction. Because
yeah,
if you're tending to do your work in the network and your data is tending to be there anyway, then it's really just a question of, oh yeah, okay, it's fine with me if it gets syndicated to these places, or it's fine with me if it's open to these search engines.
Right.
It's fine with me if access is granted to these readers.
We already have that kind of interoperability in the world of open access repositories. If they comply with what's called the Open Archives Initiative metadata harvesting protocol, then all these repositories cooperate or behave as if they were one large virtual archive for the purpose of searching.
Yep.
And people don't have to visit separate archives to run separate searches to find things.
Yep.
PubMed Central at NIH is OAI compliant.
Yep.
But so are just about every other open access archive and repository in the world. And so you can deposit in one and know that it'll be discoverable by people even if they don't know that that archive exists or what it contains.
I have kind of scratched my head and wondered, well, is this overkill? The OAI technologies and formats and protocols have reminded me of other technology initiatives that have been, let's say, over-designed, over-complex, and therefore less likely to sort of spread virally in the way that we see happening with RSS and Atom. And then we see in the world of blogging lots of organic growth of tagging and organizational
yep.
capabilities, right? So I know that people in the blog world would have that reaction. So do you think that's fair or unfair?
I think it's unfair. If these archives were hosted and sponsored primarily by individuals, it might be over-designed for that purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And blogs have to be simpler because they are written and run by individuals. But these repositories are run by institutions, and the software that runs them, and by the way, there are about a dozen open source packages for running them, all provide OAI compliance automatically. It doesn't require anybody's attention once you install the archive. The only attention it requires is to make sure that authors who deposit articles deposit metadata annotated in the article.
Right.
The archives themselves are compatible with all the add-on layers of utility that you were talking about, like social tagging.
Mm-hmm.
Connotia, the science tagging service from the Nature Publishing Group.
Yeah, I'm aware of that one.
That's been integrated with ePrint, which is the largest open access repository software.
Okay.
And it could be integrated with any of the others because they're also open source.
Okay.
And so you get the metadata harvesting interoperability at the foundation built into the software, and then you can add all these other things on top. And moreover, the mainstream search engines that are not academic, like Yahoo, Google, and Microsoft,
mm-hmm.
are harvesting these repositories. Sometimes mm-hmm. they discard the metadata. In other words, they're not taking advantage of OAI interoperability, but they want the valuable content that's inside them.
Right.
Some of them are already thinking about keeping the metadata, in other words, taking advantage of the OAI enhancements. In that sense, it's not over-designed because it makes the literature more useful, more discoverable.
So what are the features of OAI in terms of making things more useful than they would be if we did this just on a sort of a blog substrate?
Primarily, they make them more discoverable. Now, I'm comparing that to a solo archive that's not connected to anything else except through links.
Okay.
But comparing it to blogs is a nice one, a nice question, because blogs enhance discoverability
mm-hmm.
their own way, a different mm-hmm. way. And I'm not sure which is more effective. Blogs might enhance discoverability more effectively only because more people use them and know how to take advantage of those tools.
Mm-hmm.
But OAI interoperability very effectively enhances discovery for those people who know to use an OAI-compliant search engine. And I have to say, unfortunately, that not many people do know about those. Oyster, for example, at the University of Michigan, is probably the best search engine for OAI-compliant repositories.
Okay.
But I don't know how many scholars realize that it exists or realize that there are cross-archive search engines that focus specifically on scholarship.
So what kind of search am I engaged in when I use Oyster?
It's primarily a metadata search, but it's a metadata search of all the compliant repositories.
Okay.
The OAI standard allows what are called data services as opposed to data providers to write tools that comply with the standard. And so anybody can come along and write a search engine that fits the standard and can harvest or search just the archives that it wants to. So, for example, there's one that searches only the German language repositories.
Mm-hmm.
There are several that search only those within the United Kingdom. Oyster tries to search everyone it can get its hands on.
Mm-hmm.
So once you have this cross-archive searching capability, you can adjust the scope up and down depending on your purposes.
Mm-hmm.
And Oyster's decided to maximize the scope. And so it's very useful for the literature that's in those repositories. And even though it's true that Google, Yahoo, and Microsoft are trying to index the same literature, they haven't yet finished. And so Oyster is more comprehensive than
okay.
they are for that body
okay.
of literature.
But the bar to entry here really is well-formed and complete metadata.
Yes.
Yeah. So okay.
Because that's a problem, some authors don't provide it. And when they do, they provide it inconsistently.
Right. With all content management, right?
Yes.
I mean, that's just the fundamental issue.
Right.
What's the sweet spot there between the amount of metadata that you can get and the amount that you want?
Right. I think the solution won't be to find a sweet spot. The solution will be to go beyond metadata harvesting to full-text indexing.
Mm-hmm.
And the designers of the OAI standard are moving in that direction.
Hmm. But then that would bring me right back to, well, but we have that in the blog world, right?
I mean, oh, yeah, we do. And we have it in outside the scholarly world, too.
Yeah.
With Google and Microsoft and
Yahoo. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
But if we had it for scholarly repositories, then we could preserve the incentives that lead scholars to deposit in their local institutional repository and still get all the benefits, full-text indexing.
What do we mean by a repository? And it
yeah.
seems to me that there's sort of a physical and a virtual way of thinking about it. The more loosely coupled syndication way of doing things doesn't preclude you as the publisher certifying some subset of the globally available syndicated stuff as being the peer-reviewed subset.
That's right.
Without actually hosting or storing those things.
The repositories don't provide peer review.
Right.
They simply host some e-prints or papers for open access dissemination.
Right.
And for them, the reason to be a repository in the physical sense and not just the virtual sense is that they also have an interest in the long-term preservation
right.
of those works as digital works, which might otherwise disappear.
Right.
But there is something called an overlay journal that combines the functions of an open access journal with an open access repository.
Hmm.
So authors deposit a preprint in the repository, and then an editorial board, which isn't a journal in any other sense except that it's an editorial board, will take up some of those preprints as submissions, send them through their standard peer review process, whatever it is, and if they approve one, they will put it back in the repository with altered metadata showing that it's been approved.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably the least expensive way to run a peer-reviewed open access journal, and it just uses the repository as the publishing distribution medium.
Okay.
And it's very promising. I support them.
Okay.
If you're simply syndicating from your personal website, then the original will disappear if you change jobs or retire.
Right.
But if you actually put the digital original or some copy of it in a repository run by librarians who really care to keep it around, then you give it longevity.
Right.
Not only a permanent URL, but permanent bits.
Right.
And that's valuable. It's not the same as open access, but it's an enhancement to open access that makes a difference. A lot of those layers of integration and interconnectivity that make the blogosphere so useful are coming to the world of scholarly repositories.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And once this stuff is digital and locatable, I think these add-on layers are inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
People will find ways to connect them and make them integrate better.
Like the Kinotea example,
yeah,
which is,
exactly.
For people who haven't seen it, it's a, if you will, a delicious for the scholarly world.
Exactly.
Broadly speaking, then, this has been maybe, you could say, a little slow in coming, but it is coming, and it sounds like, on the whole, you're pretty hopeful about where things are headed.
Yes. A couple of years ago, I would have said it's slow in coming, and it's still an uphill fight. Now I'll say it's slow in coming, or has been slow in coming, but I think enough fires have been lit in enough places that they're not going to go out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's inevitable that the memes will keep spreading. More and more people will see the logic of it. I think I mentioned earlier, the author studies tend to show that many people still don't know about open access, but those who do get excited about it very quickly.
Right.
And I think that's the best sign that the meme will keep spreading.
Well, and as you pointed out, there's a generational aspect to this
that's
as well.
Right.
So that, you know, you start to get, I imagine, the younger faculty who are starting to, you know, show up with, you know, Live Journal and Facebook as part of their just cultural heritage, and so they, you know, have an instinct.
Yeah, and blogs and
blogs and so on. You know, that they have an instinct to be self-publishers and to be relatively transparent and public in their writing and in their thinking.
Right. The trick is to get them to realize that peer review still counts.
Yeah.
But that open access can apply to peer-reviewed literature too.
Yeah.
Or that peer review doesn't get in the way of open access.
Yeah.
So what's inevitable to me is that we will take better and better advantage of the Internet as time goes on, especially as the current generation becomes the generation of professors, librarians, university administrators, foundation managers, legislators.
Mm-hmm.
And right now we're still in the era of, let's call them, panic dinosaurs. And so there's still a lot of resistance by entrenched players. But I don't expect that's going to last a lot longer.
What I see in the world of blogs is sort of a two-tiered thing, where people in the first tier may discover that there are interesting blogs out there and may begin to follow them, and actually to this day follow them in the old-fashioned way by visiting them. And relatively few people in the mainstream, it seems to me, have kind of picked up on RSS as a way of tuning into things. But, you know, they get the idea that, well, you know, there's this person's really worth reading, and I found out about stuff I wouldn't have otherwise known, and you know, that's all good. But what they don't see, because they're not publishing into the space, is they don't see the powerful feedback effects that occur when you put your own stuff out there, and then when the reaction to your own stuff comes back to you.
Yep.
And so it's a bit of a catch-22, I think, because you can tell people that, but it doesn't really sink in until they do it. And then when they do it, it becomes a visceral sort of, well, wow, this is just amazing, you know, that,
yep,
I feel so connected. But it's almost like a leap of faith that,
yep,
you have to take.
I agree with you. And I started putting my publications online in about 1995, before there were blogs.
Yeah.
I did it just to spread the word. And almost immediately, I started getting serious emails from serious readers, just the kind that I'd always wanted to get,
yeah,
from my print publications,
yeah,
and never got.
Yeah.
And based on the responses, I was getting more readers of just the kind I wanted through the online versions than I ever got through the print versions.
Yeah.
And I've noticed in talking to other open access advocates that they didn't really commit, or they didn't really see the full advantage until they did this themselves.
Yes.
And when you do it yourself, not only do you see people writing back to you and giving you that feedback, but you get citations, you get invitations to conferences.
Yes.
You get the benefits you originally sought from publication that you didn't get because your work was behind a price barrier, and only seen by a couple hundred people instead of a couple thousand or a couple million.
Yeah.
And that's the moment of conviction or conversion.
When the tipping point comes, and it is simply automatic and routine that the stuff that you wrote for publication or not for publication is flowing through channels that are going to be publicly available, such that these feedback effects will occur really just as a matter of course, whether or not you took a conscious decision to change your behavior in order to seek out those effects. Yeah. That's when the real tipping point will come.
I agree. I've been saying that victory for us will come long before we reach 100% open access. It'll come when open access is the default.
Yeah.
And there'll always be some reason to withhold something or make an exception.
Yeah.
But when open access is the default, then we know we've gotten there.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping that every time a scholar writes a paper, publish or not publish, instead of putting it in a drawer, they'll put it in a repository.
Yeah.
Why not? You went to the trouble.
Yeah.
And as soon as more scholars understand that repositories exist and have all those benefits, primarily open access, but secondarily preservation, they should do that. It only takes a couple minutes. If they put it in a drawer, or if they only send it to a price journal whose price is so high that most libraries can't subscribe, that's essentially locking it away.
Yep.
They have a citation that they can give to their promotion and tenure committee, but that's all they've got. They don't have an audience. They don't have impact.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I really appreciate the chance to spread the message through this interview.
This was fun. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, John.
Yeah, take care.
Okay.